Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. Welcome to the Electric Drum. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I'm speaking with Reverend Odell Cooper. How are you doing today, ma'am?
I'm doing well with yourself. How are you?
I'm doing excellent and better now that I'm talking to you. Tell me a little bit about yourself, Ms. Cooper. Where are you from?
Oh, originally, I'm born in Harlem, raised between Harlem and Boston. My mother had me at a late age and didn't really want any children. So my family raised me in Boston. So I found myself, back and forth between Boston and New York. So, which was a great life because, as they say, on Mondays through Friday, I was, family, values, collard greens, government cheese. and then when I would go to New York, five-star restaurants and Broadway and international travels. So that's who I am.
Wow. Who were you with in Boston?
Oh, my grandmother helped raise me and my cousin.
Your grandmother? Please,
so
names.
I grew up having two mothers, and I'm named after my grandmother, Odell.
Odell, and then your cousin was?
Her name was Doretha Woodson, She has since passed. Yes, so she was my cousin, and she raised me, but I've always known her as my mother.
What kind of lesson do you get from those ladies in Boston that sticks with you today, like a value or a saying that, when you're making tough decisions?
My families were the Thompsons, and those Thompson women were very tough and direct. They loved you, but they were direct with you. And my lessons from them were family values, the importance of family and culture. That's what they taught me. And that is what I carry today.
Wow. Now, you spent some time in New York City on the weekends.
Oh, yes. And then my mother, with my father, they were in New York. And, my mother taught me culture. Mm-hmm. She would say, you can't be uncouth. So I want to teach you how to go out and eat in a restaurant, how to travel. And she introduced to me the finer side of life. And other options.
May I ask her, what was their names?
I didn't hear you.
What was their names?
Oh, my mother's name was Mary Montgomery, and my father is Duke Montgomery.
Oh, okay. I'd like to get names with stories, because
important. Yes, Mary and Duke in New York, and Doretha, and we just called her Mama Doe. and called her Mama Doe. That was her name because she raised so many cousins. You have that family member that raised so many cousins, and you all grow up as brothers and sisters.
Wow. Do you ever feel any angst towards your parents for not, being there or living with them full time?
Early on, no. But not until, I wrote my first book that I even started to think about why my mother didn't keep me. So I had to do some soul searching. So, no, my mother was always in my life. She would catch the bus back and forth, the Greyhound bus back and forth and see me, or I would be in New York. So even though I didn't live with her, she was an integral part of my life.
But then when you said or later in life, you kind of questioned it. What was the process like?
The process of questioning was after, and you get older, you start looking back on your life, it's why. And I never asked her why. And so my answer that I came up with is that she's always said that she didn't want any children. She was a chef. And she was 41 when she had me. So she chose a career. And my father was, and Duke was 10 years her senior and had already had multiple children with multiple women and didn't want any more. So my mother didn't want any children. Mm. And then I happened. And so I'm not mad at her for saying this is my, you know, I'm assuming that she said, I want to keep the man and I want my career, but I'm still going to make sure my daughter is raised properly and I'm a part of her life. So that was a mother's decision and no judgment there. I turned out very well.
To say the least, young lady. With that said, how important is it to have those tough discussions when people are still alive? Because it sounds like you never got to have that discussion. What would your advice be to someone who is going through something similar?
You can't judge parents. Parents make decisions based on their life, their values, and what's going on for them. And we may not see it, understand it, or respect it until you become a parent. So you just have to trust and respect a parent's decision. And make the best decisions that you can. You may not raise your children, but be a part of their life. So I can never say that I didn't know my biological mother or my father and they weren't in my life. I don't need to sit on somebody's couch for counseling about where my parents were and what they did not do. They did. My mom made sure she was in my life. And my father was, you know, my father, he was present. We didn't have a strong relationship, but I had a father. Hmm.
Going back and forth between Boston and New York, of course, people of color are treated differently in these environments. And growing up, did you notice that? That little difference between New York and Boston?
Oh, it was a big difference. As I mentioned to you, in Boston, it was family, culture, you know, collard greens, black eyed peas, pig feet. That's how we grew up in Boston. And when I went to New York, I'm eating at, you know, East Side, 5-star restaurants. So the change was me, because after a while, I remember I was probably 16 when my mother took me to Waldorf Astoria. And we had brunch. And then it was so great. She took me back for lunch and I had filet mignon. And I can tell you, when I went back to Boston, I said, I didn't want any pig feet because the filet mignon was still savoring in my mouth. and, you know, Boston's lifestyle, parents did not say, well, if you don't want this, what else do you want? It's either eat this or you don't eat. Mm. So she was like, okay, you don't have to eat this, but I'm not cooking anything else for you. and that's it. And that's how I am today with my granddaughter, who says, well, that's not what I want. I'm like, well, that's what I cooked. So either you eat or you eat or you starve.
Choices, right? You have to make choices in life.
Choices in life.
No.
Yes, I'm not your short order cook.
Now, being educated and traveling between both environments, do you feel like you were treated differently as a African-American woman? You know, the society in Boston, which I can only assume in that time was a little bit different, and the treatment of people of color versus your experience in New York, or were you shielded from that?
Well, no, I wasn't shielded because I lived in Dorchester when I grew up in Boston, and Boston was always known for being racist. And it was when the schools, I was part of the busing. So people were being bused from South Boston and from South Boston, which is predominantly white, coming into the black neighborhoods, and they shipped and they bused us out. So racism was definitely a key. I remember going to school and having parents use the N-word, the girls using N-words at you where you had to go to the bathroom with somebody so you weren't by yourself. So I saw the hatred and the racism growing up in Boston, but I didn't see it in New York. I didn't see it until one day my bus from Boston was late. I never knew why my mother always wanted me to come to Port Authority during the day and not at night. And one time my bus was late and I arrived around 7 o'clock on a Friday night. And I can tell you the atmosphere was totally different than I had ever seen in my entire life. That was when whatever you want to buy, sell was available at Port Authority bus stop. And my mother was, I can't keep you safe. And we got in a cab and wanted to leave. And she said to me, you look like everybody else. You know, I had the afro, the pick in my head, the plastic yellow belt, the bell bottoms. She said, you look like everybody else. And you can't look like that at night because you blend in and I need to keep you safe. And that was my first experience of understanding cultural differences, looking at New York in the daytime and New York at night.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario here talking with Reverend O, Odell Cooper. Education-wise, you were being bused. Did you end up going to high school and college? And well, how was your experiences?
Yes. I finished high school at Boston Technical High School in 1980. And after high school, I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York for 2 years. And I can tell you the first thing I wanted to do was go to a party. I said, I want to go to a party. And they were like, a what? I said, I want to go to a party. And they were like, don't talk. Okay, you got that Boston accent. Don't talk. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I had so much fun going to Studio 54, the Garage, Melons Club. I mean, I was doing grit in school, but I partied on the weekends. And a cousin of mine who graduated from Howard University had graduated and was living around the corner on Washington Street. And he said to me, you're wasting your life. You're partying too much and you have too much to offer. And he took me to Howard University, and I was there for spring break. And when I saw all the students of color, the fraternities, the sororities, it was like a different world. And that's exactly what it was. And I ended up transferring that next year and being a student and graduating from Howard University.
People don't understand HBCUs and how much pride it instills in a person when you are surrounded by gentlemen that are in suits 24/7 if you're part of the business school and they have certain traditions there on top of their sorority and fraternities. What can you say about community and what you learned there?
Oh, at Howard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, man, it was truly about being black, and you're black and powerful and strong and educated. And I had not been around that environment my entire life. College students that looked like me, professors, and the education they was teaching you that you have to be better because this is the world that you're in. And when it was just an awesome experience of empowerment, being powerful, being loved, being respected, and understanding that you walk in the skin that you're in. And then you're on campus and you're looking at these buildings named after historians who fought for you and paved the way. It was just an awesome experience to be surrounded by powerful black excellence. I'm not going to say, but I will say, and when I saw the sororities and fraternity steps, I knew that's where I wanted to be connected.
Did you enjoy it? Did you become a soror?
I did. I pledged Delta Sigma Theta sorority, but I didn't pledge undergraduate. Unfortunately, when I was on campus, The chapter was suspended, so I ended up pledging the alumni chapter at Ithaca Alumni. After Howard University, I went and took a job at Cornell University. So I was there for 2 years. And while I was there, I was going to school for culinary and working. And that is where I pledged Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated.
See, it's never too late to join one of these frats or sorority. I mean, sororities. I know the Sigmas in here in New Haven are always looking for somebody, too. So,
yes.
It's never too late. Just got to have enough college credits to get in.
And that's it.
With that said, you said you started working at Ithaca. What's a job that really sticks out to you that where you feel like you taught you what business is like, or what being a corporate person is like?
My first introduction was at Cornell University, being a Black woman. And, you know, from D.C. and you're in Ithaca, culture is different. The environment is different. And there's not many of us integrated on the campus. So it was trying to find us. But the business part that I learned from Cornell was understanding food management and understanding unions and language and relationships. And that was something that I took with me for the rest of my career.
Mm. So it was first job.
First job. How you show up, how you present yourself. Now, people may not accept you because of the color of your skin and where you're from, but that too shall pass. Build relationship, get through the conflict, and build it on trust and respect, and always be a person of your word. And that's who I learned to be.
Things that you have to learn out in the real world. Now, I want to talk about culture shock, because you've been in several different environments. You went from Boston, to New York, D.C., because DMV is so different down there.
Yes.
All the way up to Ithaca, which, like you said, very few. What was the most culture shock for you? What was the hardest for you to adjust to, and what did you do to adjust?
I would say the culture shock was being at Howard, because you can just go to school and back to your dorm and only see people of color. And then as I left D.C. to go home for the weekend and I was driving on the highway, I said, oh, a white person, you know, so I hadn't seen a white person almost a whole semester, depending on where you were. So that was very different. And then going up to Ithaca was another culture shock, because I was a Black woman. I was coming in. I'm a Howard University graduate. I hit the campus with my shirt, Black by Popular Demand, Howard University. This is it. And white folks were intimidated, and they didn't know my culture. They didn't want to know and didn't have to know, because their daddies had and their parents were paying for their way with cash to go to school for 4 years. And they were focused and on a mission. And I think being in Ithaca was the first time I had a friend who was a white woman that I can call a friend. And I was 22 at that time.
Hmm. It's something of the sense of safety, right? It's different when you're at Howard, because you actually felt safe in Howard. Do you not feel as safe in any of these other environments compared to Howard, being around your own people?
I don't know if I felt unsafe in any of them. More unsafe trying to navigate from Boston Tech to South Boston. That's where you're unsafe. You know, those areas where you cannot go. You cannot go. And that was home. But in D.C., everybody was the same color as you. So I never felt unsafe while I was in D.C. because I could move and function and travel and it wasn't an issue. I was just cautious and mindful of who I was when I was in Ithaca because it was a different culture. But I needed to respect the culture that I was in because I was going, because I was working. So I was a professional, not a student. So I had to act accordingly. But I always felt, I never put myself in danger, put it to you that way.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. This is Reverend Odell Cooper and her story of greatness, because that's all we are, right? You're a reverend. What made you turn to the Lord, or when do you see your calling?
That's a good question.
Or hear your calling, I should say.
I was married and had children, and I had said to my daughter, Jackie, when she was probably about six, she says, I want to go to church. And I said, church? I said, okay. And I didn't take her to church that Sunday because I needed to do laundry, you know, laundry for us, all of this. And she made my life miserable that entire week. And from that point on, I said, okay, we're going to find a church for you. And I started taking her to a church. It was in West Haven. Living Word Ministry was the first church that we really went to here. And she loved the Bible study, and she loved Sunday school. And because I needed to be involved as a parent in the church and her activities, I started, the pastor said, well, you can't serve unless you're saved in Christ. And that's where I gave my life at Living Word. I gave my life to God at Living Word Ministry. And then I was having problems in my marriage, and my husband didn't like Living Word Ministry. He didn't like the culture because it was a non-denominational church. And we were having issues and started to separate. And we knew that we needed God in our life in order to make the marriage work. So we ended up going to Barak Amy Zion Church on Dixwell Avenue as a family.
We skipped a whole section of how you ended up in New Haven.
Oh, I'm sorry. How I ended up in New Haven.
Yeah, let's go back. Let's backtrack a little bit. Okay.
Let's back a little bit. When I was at Cornell, I met my husband. He and I worked in the same department and got married. My family lived here in New Haven. My sister lived here. So I knew that we wanted to have a family. And I'm like, I need to be around someone that can help me because I don't know what to do. So we came here. And my husband and I were supposed to be in New Haven for 3 years. And he wanted to go to Florida. But here it is, 30 years later, I'm here. And he's in North Carolina and we're divorced.
Oh, okay. So he needed some heat. He got tired of the cold winters. You started a business and now you have a nonprofit entity that you have and is called
Interruptions. Interruptions is the language of my business. This wasn't anything that I thought I wanted to do. I was perfect in my career. I had a bachelor's degree in food and nutrition. I was a certified Microsoft instructor, and I was teaching and working in project management. So I was working well in my career. And then an interruption happened in my life. And that's what's me starting my new path. So the business is called Interruptions.
And what services does it provide?
So interruptions happened when 9 years ago, I was the director of Concat Culinary School. We had just opened and we had Friends and Family Day. My son was living in New York. I sent him to New York so that he could have a longer lifespan because the lifespan of a young black man in New Haven was 18 to 20 years old. And I wanted him to have life options. So he started going to school and working in New York. He came home for an event. My daughter was a student enrolled in Concats Culinary School. The event was Friends and Family Day. And we took a beautiful picture. 12 hours later, he was murdered by mistaken identity. And that was the beginning of a new path for me. That night activated my trauma, my PTSD, all my mental health issues that I didn't have language for or didn't know about. And then being a reverend, I'm torn and confused between God's will and life. And who am I supposed to be angry at? And why are these things happening? And it took me a very long time to wrestle with that and make peace with that. And being a reverend, we're told or taught that if things happen to you, it's God's will. And I could not accept that. That wasn't helping me to heal. So I began to question my faith, my culture, and I wanted to know who told me these things and why did I believe them and were they helping me to heal? And then I found out that my faith was hindering my healing because I needed to see a therapist. I needed to see a doctor. And I didn't do it. And a year later, on my son's birth date, I had a brain aneurysm. And that doctor told my family to stop praying for me. I was going to die.
And do you believe that the aneurysm was brought on by stress?
Oh, stress.
And this,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, stress, PTSD that activated. And mm-hmm. I was believing the myths and stigmas that I don't need a therapist, that mm-hmm. if it happened, it's God's will, I'll be okay. I'm the strong Black woman. Mm-hmm. I believed all those myths and stigmas until it wasn't helping me to heal. And the stress of it is what the stress, and also I learned that a brain aneurysm is hereditary. And I didn't know that. So my family, they didn't sit down and say, this is my health. This is what I have. This is what's been in the family. We never had those conversations. So I didn't know what my parents' health was like. It was a secret. They kept that a secret until I inherited it and I'm dealing with it. And that was a struggle for me to figure out. I'm blaming God for this brain aneurysm, and it wasn't God's fault. Years later, I had to reconcile with God didn't kill my son. People made a bad decision, and evil took his life. The faith that I am as a Christian, God saved his soul, and the reason why I have a brain aneurysm, because it's hereditary, and when my body was telling me that you're sick, you're tired, you hurt, I ignored it. Because of all the myths and stigmas of my faith and my culture, I ignored it. And I learned you cannot ignore your health or your body because it's talking to you.
And when it yells, it does scream, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
You survived this brain aneurysm. They counted you out, but you didn't count yourself out. How was that process for you?
Process was horrible because I'm stubborn. And I learned that I'm stubborn. And I was the only one that didn't realize that I had a brain aneurysm and almost died, had surgery for 8 hours. And I had to, I'm thinking, I'm in the hospital, I'm in the ER, I'm in ICU. I have a tube draining the blood off my brain into a bag. And I'm saying, I got to go to work. I have to go to work. And people are looking at me like, no, relax, you're not going to work. And trying to understand that level of health challenges by myself was difficult because the doctors didn't do a very good job in explaining it to me. They still thought, here, she's here, but she's not going to make it. But I had to learn how to read and write. I had to go to Southern University to their communications department. I had to learn how to read and write and speak again. And I did that for 3 years. And I learned my body. I had to learn how to walk again, how to have balance. Because when I tell you I was walking in my house and walking into the walls that weren't moving and chairs, and my daughter's looking at me like, what are you doing? And my balance was off. So my doctor suggested that I go take Tai Chi to help me get my balance together. And then I had to go and start working my body, going to a gym and moving my muscles and working my body again. After 4 years of no movement, I had to relearn how to move my body, how to rethink, how to use my mind, and to accept, I'm still struggling with that, my challenges of this brain aneurysm.
Wow. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and utter all of Reverend Odell Cooper's journey. Resilience is one of those qualities that the youth at times is challenged by in this day and age, but in perseverance.
Yes.
I mean, you say it's stubborn, but can it be called mental fortitude? Or?
I'll call it stubborn, only because of the fact that I was grieving my healthy self. Doctors told me no travel. When I tell you I couldn't get in my car and put gas in my car, I didn't know how to put gas in my car and how to pay for gas. I didn't know how to get to Whaley Avenue without a GPS. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't talk longer than 20 minutes without being exhausted and feeling like I worked a 20-hour day. So I'm thinking I can re-engage myself. And when I tell you being stubborn, I was able to go to a Stevie Wonder concert at the MGM studio in Springfield when they opened up the casino. I went to the Stevie Wonder concert against my doctor's will, and I was sick in the bed for a week. I went to a Dallas football game in Dallas, Texas, and I'm a Dallas fan, and I did it, and I knew I was going to physically, mentally pay for it, and I did. I got sick. I paid for it. When I returned, I was in the bed, no movement for 2 weeks to get my body settled again. So things I wasn't supposed to do, like drive to Boston, catch a train. I couldn't even catch Amtrak to Boston to go back home and to know where I was or what I was doing. People had to meet me at the gate and pick me up, not physically pick me up, but make sure that I was okay, because I would be confused about where I was. And that's the town that I grew up in. And that's the challenging piece.
The miracle of the brain, because those synapses come back with training, with patience. And all the while you're dealing with your son's death.
Yes.
And you're personally growing. You know, and they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but you learned a couple of What was the most helpful thing that you learned during that process that got you through everything?
One, my faith. I stopped blaming God for what was happening to me. And what I learned was I am persistent. That's always been a characteristic of mine. When I pledged Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated in Ithaca, my line name was Persistent. And so for me, having a therapist, and I wanted to know language, what was going to happen, she taught me how to accept my brain aneurysm, my new life, and to give me positive language. So instead of saying, I can't do something, I can't read. So I can't read the pages of a book like I used to. So instead of saying that I can't, I can listen to an audio book. And I can't drive at night. Well, go in the day and stay home at night. So I've learned, you know, those things, you're like, that's logical. It's not logical when you are so used to doing it on your own. Traveling, love to travel, but I have to travel with someone, can't travel alone because I get confused. So now I'm open and honest about who I am, my challenges, and the needs that I have. And I have no problems helping people who are close to me understand this is what I need if you're going to be in my immediate space so that I'm safe and I function and I'm going to be okay. Honesty.
Wow. Honesty with yourself and with people around you. What is the name of the nonprofit? What is its purpose?
The nonprofit is, there's a first. There's an LLC. We started with the LLC Interruptions because I wanted to teach people how to deal with interruptions in their life. And interruptions were not just losing a son. It's you got married, you got divorced, you got a new job, the pandemic hits, anything that interrupts or your flow of life. You're a grandmother. Oh, you're a stepmother of a grown teenager. Anything that changes your life. So I've used my story from trauma to healing to help people to identify those languages and behaviors of mental health and how to work through our culture and faith. So that's what the Interruptions LLC does for the last 5 years. And we've been awarded a grant from Clifford Beers to offer the training, the book that I wrote, and the workbook that I designed to, with the help of others, trust me, to offer this trauma-informed training to others so that they could find their path towards healing. And just last year, November, we started a nonprofit called the Interruption Project. And we are going to continue to be a resource to the faith community and to the secular world to help them to understand how to deal and help people of faith and people of color when we are coming and sitting in their chair and going to the doctor, how to ask us the right questions, and also how we are responsible for telling our doctor the truth and not just saying, I'm blessed and highly favored, but going home and can't sleep and can't move and function. So the nonprofit is now up and running, and that's going to be our focus. We're here to provide tools and resources to the faith-based community to help them to understand that mental health and faith work side by side, and you need them both.
What's the website?
Oh, we don't have a website yet.
What's the contact information? You got an email?
The LLC has a website.
Okay.
And the website is interruptionswithoutwalls.com. Yes.
Very
interruptionswithoutwalls.com. That is the LLC's website. That is the branch that's starting the nonprofit. So we are just forming. We have a wonderful board. We have people from the community who are on the board, and we're excited. We have Deborah Stanley McCauley is on the board.
Mm-hmm.
We have Reverend Streets from Yale Divinity School. We have Kathy Patton, my dear friend, even though she's of a different sorority. We have Richard Pierce, who does finances and counting. We have another person who's up in Hartford. She's a Microsoft, Stephanie Smith. She's a Microsoft specialist, a project manager, and my son's best friend, Marcel Brown, who has been with me along this journey of healing, and he's coming on board with his skills and process to help. How do we help others?
Wow. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate everything and sharing. Again, everyone out there, this is Reverend Odell Cooper, Interruptions Without Walls, right? interruptions without walls.com is her contact. Please reach out if you're interested in her services. I just think that what you're doing is phenomenal. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing.
Thank you.
This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and like always, thank you for taking the time to listen.